You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative talents at one of the world's great opera companies. For additional podcast interviews, subscribe to our RSS feed or visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Soprano Natalie Dessay, tenor Jonas Kaufmann, and conductor Emmanuel Villaume are backstage at Lyric.
David treats us as actors, so that's my interest in life. That's all. I want to act. I don't care about singing.
They're period costumes, but they're not behaving like that. But I think they're behaving like people would probably have behaved in that time, but nobody would have said that in public or even brought that on stage.
It doesn't matter, really, if you update a piece or not. What matters is the coherency of what you do. If it's really making sense from a point of view of relationship between the text, the music, and eventually the society in which and the time in which you live.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. For this episode, we're playing an audio transcript of the Lyric Opera Discovery Series session for Massenet's Manon. For those of you who may not be aware of the Discovery Series, it's panel discussions featuring singers, conductors, directors, and opera experts. We do one session per opera, and they usually take place a few days prior to the opening performance. The Discovery Series is open to the public, and it's a great way to get up close and personal with our artists. You can check out our website at lyricopera.org for dates, tickets, and complete Discovery Series information. We include all of the Discovery Series sessions as part of the Backstage at Lyric podcast. And now, on to the Discovery Series panel featuring Natalie Dessay, Jonas Kaufmann, and Emmanuel Villaume. I'm your host for this session, and I hope you enjoy it.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Roger Pines. I'm dramaturg at Lyric Opera Chicago. I'm delighted to welcome you to our opening session of the 2008-2009 Discovery Series. And this session is devoted to an opera that Lyric is producing for the first time in a quarter century, Massenet's Manon. I think we were just waiting for the right leading lady, leading man, and conductor to come along, and you are about to meet all three of them. Nathalie Dessay created a sensation in both her previous roles at Lyric, Morgana in Alcina, and the title role of Lucia di Lammermoor. She is internationally acknowledged as the most remarkable operatic artist France has produced in decades. In recent seasons, the Met, Covent Garden, the Vienna Staatsoper, and the Opéra National de Paris have all staged productions especially for her. She's amassed an award-winning discography and videography, including most recently a CD of La Sonnambula, which she is singing at the Met in a new production, and a movie theater simulcast later this season. A brand new CD and DVD compilation of some of her finest performances is entitled The Miracle of a Voice. Jonas Kaufmann won great praise for his American debut with us as Cassio in Otello and for his return to Lyric as Alfredo in La Traviata. He is widely acknowledged as Germany's most outstanding tenor on international stages, and his versatility is unique. His recent performances range from Fidelio in Zurich to Carmen at Covent Garden and Traviata at La Scala. He is making his role debut as Lohengrin at next summer's Munich Festival. He's a remarkable concert artist and recitalist. His discography includes everything from songs by Richard Strauss and operatic arias to complete operas of Mozart, Weber, and Wagner. Emmanuel Villaume, who was with us previously to conduct Sanson et Dalila, is music director of Spoleto USA in Charleston, South Carolina, and also the newly appointed music director of the Slovenian Philharmonic in Ljubljana. He's conducted innumerable French works on major stages worldwide, from the Met and San Francisco to the major houses of Paris, London, Venice, and many more. He's a frequent guest conductor for orchestras all over America and Europe, and this season is bringing him to Los Angeles for Carmen, Berlin for Tosca, and Turin for Les Contes d'Hoffmann. Please join me in welcoming to the Discovery Series Nathalie Dessay, Jonas Kaufmann, and Emmanuel Villaume. Okay, the first thing we have to do, since we haven't done Manon in 25 years, is that I need to do my quickie version of the story. In a nutshell, Manon is being sent by her family to a convent. Her coach stops at an inn where she rejects the overtures made to her by a wealthy fop, Guillot de Morfontaine. She meets Chevalier des Grieux. The two fall in love. They steal Guillot's coach and run off to Paris. They live together there, but Manon is soon tempted away from des Grieux by the significantly wealthier Bretigny. When Manon hears that des Grieux has entered a seminary, she rushes there and seduces him into abandoning his intention to become a priest. After the two spend all their money enjoying the high life, Manon persuades des Grieux to acquire a new fortune by gambling. Guillot challenges des Grieux at the gambling table. After repeatedly losing, he accuses des Grieux of cheating and brings the police. The young man's father, a count, saves him from prison, but Manon is arrested as des Grieux's accomplice. He finds her on the road to Le Havre, exhausted and soon to be deported, but she dies in his arms. Is that okay?
It's good.
Almost.
Finally, I got it.
In a nutshell.
What is it missing?
Already suppose that she's a femme fatale and she wants everything at the same time.
Well, that's what she is.
No.
I want to talk in great detail about both of these characters, but first I wanted to start by asking Emmanuel to sum up for us what makes this piece so incredibly appealing purely on the musical side.
I think Manon is the only opera of Massenet that stayed in the repertoire of all theaters since the creation of the piece in 1884. So it has whatever you expect from a good French score, which is, first of all, elegance. As we know, we are all very elegant people. a sense of color that is very, very, very strong. Beautiful orchestration, but in a very light way, in a way that is a lot of finesse and so on. It's a very powerful score. At the same time, I think what is very specific about that piece is the authenticity in which feelings are expressed. There is a great picture of life, either at his in teenagers with a lot of hormones getting together and whatever can happen there, expressed in the most, not graphic, but in the most poetical way, in a very, very powerful way, and also a feeling of time passing from an historical point of view, from a political point of view, or from a personal point of view. So it's a very touching piece musically, and at the same time, it's a big fresque, lot of colors and lot of energy. So that it's one of the most remarkable pieces of the repertoire, and that's why I think it did stay all that time in most of the opera houses.
Natalie, is this a piece that you've known most of your life, or did you come to it late, or how were you introduced to it?
No, because I knew I was going to do it one day, but the Cour La Reine aria was one of my first aria when I started to study the singing, I didn't have the right voice till a few years ago because I was really, really a high soprano. So it needs a bit more medium, you know, in the voice.
So the roles that you had before this, that is Ophelia and Hamlet and Lachmé and Juliet, were they good preparation for it?
Yeah, I didn't have a choice because that's the problem with the opera. You do what your voice tells you to do.
Right.
But that was interesting in a way, but I didn't want to stay with that repertoire forever.
Jonas, you're making your role debut in this production. You came to some other French operas. One was Carmen, Donation de Faust. Prior to Manon, was that just because of circumstances, or did you deliberately intend to try those other roles first before you got around to des Grieux?
No, definitely not. I mean, usually you would do it the other way around because des Grieux is definitely not as, it is as dramatic as the others you were mentioning before, so you wouldn't start with Damnation, but that's what I did. For me, again, it's been the circumstances, not because of my vocal abilities, but mainly because of the market. Because when you're young, when you can't just choose everything, I mean, you have to take what you can get. And after you, it's by the time you climb up the ladder in your career, then you can choose, and then you can say, this is good for my voice and this is not. But I mean, I was very confident and I loved it. It's Damnation is still one of my absolutely favorite pieces, and I think it's so gorgeous and beautiful. So I didn't regret it at all. But now, thank God, I'm coming to some more French things like Manon or some of those that are upcoming.
Now, I usually save the production aspect until later in the discussion, but this production is so incredibly intriguing and imaginative that I think we should devote a little more time to it than usual. But first, before we talk about the specifics of what Lyric is doing with Manon, let me just ask, you know, this is a piece that is often updated. I mean, I was just watching a DVD of a production that takes place in the 1950s, for example. Although our actual staging is not exactly traditional, our costumes are definitely, you know, 18th century, recognizably so. So do you feel that this is a timeless story and can be updated, or do you much prefer to see it in the period in which it was written?
Well, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I think it's a very good question, Roger, and thank you for asking the question. I think it doesn't matter really if you update a piece or not. What matters is the coherency of what you do. If it's really making sense from a point of view of relationship between the text, the music, and eventually the society in which and the time in which you live. In that case, David McVicar, we can say very clearly, has done, I mean, a remarkable job. I think what he was trying to do is, first of all, to really understand those characters. Now, he's putting it in a social context that is definitely the beginning of the, you know, at between 17th and 18th century, in a way that would not go with the cliché of we have of the end of the 18th century before the French Revolution. It's a little different. And in that way, you have costumes, as you said, that are very clearly evoking a certain time in history. But it's just an entry, a door into a story. It's not making any strong political statement or even sociological statement about it. Of course, there is an advantage to that time, is that it can be so exquisite and lavish in the costumes and decadent, and then people who go to the opera for the bad reason, just to have colors and beautiful dresses, will get that, and we actually can enjoy that.
Let me add something. I think there's a general discussion always going on about updating an opera or not, and I once was very, very much with the lovers of updating an opera. Just because I thought people would have an easier access to it, especially younger people. Also, a story that plays in another century is maybe not as touching as the one that can happen round the door or can happen even to yourself. So, but I think it's a mistake. The problem is that you sometimes destroy part of the mystery of the spirit of an opera if you really just with force try to put it in nowadays, just to make it modern, to because it's fancy. And I think that's absolutely wrong. And what you were saying it's the period costumes, but they are not behaving like that, more or less. But I think they're behaving like people would probably have behaved in that time, but nobody would have said that in public or even brought that on stage, because it was not it was not allowed to behave very, very normal on stage. Stage was always something mythical, something a fairy tale more than the normal life. And that has changed, thank God. And so we can combine those two things, because people at that time were also human. They weren't heroes or saints or whatever you would call them. And another argument to keep it in that period is probably because some of the relationships, like my relationship to my father, is in that time extremely credible and normal. But now it's something people wouldn't accept, that my father has so much power about me and that I have to obey whatever he says. It's something that, especially in our generation, became a little bit rare or whatever, or even odd, unfortunately. So it would steal part of the power of the story.
Mm-hmm. Now, Natalie, you had said in an interview for our magazine that you were so totally satisfied with this particular production.
It's not because it's 18th century or 19th or 21st, or I don't care. What I care is that it's directed, but really directed. That means David treats us as actors. So that's my interest in life. That's all. I want to act. I don't care about singing.
And he actually, he's so musically together as a director in a way.
Yeah, he's really well prepared. He knows it by heart. He loves it. And he's interested in the relationships between people. That's all. Plus, I must add that this story couldn't happen after the 50s anyway, because till the 50s, the society was quite strict for the women, you know. After that, the women got to be more free.
Yeah.
So, but till the 50s, it was difficult for someone to make a living without having a personal fortune or without doing studies or anything like that. So also this Manon, she has no choice at one point. You know, they don't have money anymore. And she doesn't want to end in the street.
Well... There's a convent, dear.
Yeah, exactly.
Who wants to go to the convent?
People were praying for you, my dear.
I wanted to ask our French natives on the panel, did the two of you, Emmanuel and Natalie, did you study the novel by the Abbé Prévost in school?
No,
not at all.
Thank God, no. It's a bad novel.
It's a bad novel.
Yeah.
No, it's a footnote in French literature. The novel is interesting in the way that it is the embodiment of the spirit of what we call libertinage.
Yeah, but it's the 18th century or the 17th century scene.
Absolutely.
One century later, anyway.
Yes.
And it's the story of De Grieux more than the story of Manon, by the way.
But this is one of the cases where the opera has had a depth, a quality, an energy that the model from which it is inspired didn't have, I would say. When I meet the Abbé Prévost in hell or in heaven, I will apologize for that. But I think this is very true.
What's interesting is that she's totally appealing in the opera, and she's not at all in the novel. And she it takes her the entire novel to say to De Grieux, I know that I'm unworthy of this affection that you have for me. And so you feel just a little bit for her, but in a way it's too late. Whereas in the opera, she's utterly captivating from beginning to end, I find.
And you in the opera, at least, I don't know how Natalie and Jonas feel about that, but you really feel that although she's calculating a lot of things, she loves De Grieux with no question.
She's not calculating anything. That's the point.
See, she's not calculating anything.
Because if she would do that, she wouldn't end like that.
Well, she lost also. She was playing cards and...
No, she wants everything right now.
All right.
That's all.
Right, well, she's paying for that, yeah.
She's a teenager.
Wow.
Well, she really is. I mean, 16.
Yeah.
Well, look at her. I mean,
yeah.
She's young.
The perfect casting. I mean, hello.
Since we're talking since we're talking about character right now, why don't I just ask Natalie about that first scene? You know, when we see her at the inn and we know so little about her, what do you imagine as this girl's background? Where does she come from? We know she's going to a convent, but where is she coming from?
She did a big mistake, and I can't tell what. So that's why she's sent to the convent.
She likes pleasure too much.
It contains,
she actually says it. That's what she says.
Yeah, rude language or what's that?
J'aime trop le plaisir.
Right.
No, that's the family. That's her family.
No, she said that's what the family says.
Yeah.
But
she doesn't. You know,
right.
She likes to be alive.
Yeah.
And she likes life and good things in life. That's all.
Does all of that immediately come through when you sing your first aria, or does it take us some time to? Or do you think we know her almost immediately? I mean,
no, and I don't know her either. I mean, everything. You know, the thing which is interesting with Manon is that everything which happens to her is for the first time. Almost everything. I mean, but many things.
So at the end of that first aria, we know that she has this incredible.
She has the desire to live a good life with everything she wants, everything she likes. She wants to go out. She wants to go to the restaurant. She wants to go and to have fun.
And do we get that? How does that come across musically, do you think? I mean, as she moves from one aria, she has an aria in every act. Is it the arias or is it her dialogue with Des Grieux where we get that? Where does her character come through most sort of vividly for you?
I don't know. It's little by little. Because at the beginning, she regrets to go to convent and she says, voyons, Manon, plus de chimère. Let's stop dreaming. And then he arrives, and she says to herself, oh, why not?
I think it's so interesting that she is the one who suggests that they take the coach. I mean, Des Grieux.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
I mean, she's the sort of proactive one in this relationship.
Well, definitely, yes.
Yeah. Jonas, can we talk about Des Grieux's background? I mean, we know that he's going to, when we see him at the inn, he's going off to be with his father, and he's looking forward to that. But where is he coming from, and what are his circumstances?
Well, I think he's a student. So maybe the term is over, so he goes home to his daddy for his summer holidays. And I don't think he's enjoying that very much. I mean, I don't know if... you can understand that, follow the idea that he maybe doesn't like to be at home, to listen to his father all the time, to be always the second son. He's not the first, he's the second. So that means he's always one step underneath the other. And so he probably did enjoy his life as a student and the idea to come back home and sit there at the table and behave is probably not his dream come true. So when he sees that girl and he immediately falls in love, he thinks, that's it. And I mean, after like, we see each other for a minute and I'm saying, you're the woman of my life. Let's run away. So, I mean, obviously he must be very inexperienced because... It's not that you. I mean, he's very, very clever. He says that to every woman, just to. But I mean, what, it can be one or the other. But it seems a little bit strange that he falls in love so desperately in a split second.
Song.
Well, yes, but still,
it exists.
Yeah.
Okay.
What is extraordinary in these productions that it is somehow, from the point of view of the librettist and Massenet himself, a convention that you would fall in love in three bars and decide to live together in the next four bars.
It
probably exists, Natalie. I'm sure that. But the work they all did, or we all did, I must say, makes it actually believable. And I always thought, well, come on, I mean, just no, who's kidding who? And actually, going step by step, you have this freshness, this teenager will and desire and libido that Natalie is talking about, that makes it totally believable. And I think this is pretty remarkable, because we have the tendency to look down at these operas and say, well, this doesn't make any sense. This, and all of a sudden, there is at least a logic that makes it totally true and palpable, and you can totally communicate to that.
Well, that's the magic of opera.
Absolutely. I mean,
look closely to all every plot of an opera, I mean, let's be honest, I mean, it's not really thrilling. I mean, you look at it and say, oh, come on. I mean, it's opera logic and everything. But once the whole thing is put together, you see the staging, you see the music, and it's so overwhelming, people start crying and they just can't...
In this case, I think the story is great. In this case, the story works and is believable. We have to be good actors also, and to make it believable. But this story in particular is a good story in comparison of many other operas.
You're right.
Good. Trovatore.
There was a lovely moment in the rehearsal footage of the DVD of this production, where I'm wondering if you remember the discussion that you and David and Mr. Villazon had about Manon's name. And can you describe that whole... Because that was not something I'd ever thought of before.
No, but it's a little detail. It's a little detail. When she says, je m'appelle, Manon is laughing because he thinks it's really ridiculous. It's a ridiculous name, like Molly. You know, Molly, what is that name? You know, but it's
well, all the Mollies in the room, don't take it personally. It's fine.
No, but...
We love you. Hi, Molly. Go on, Natalie, go on.
No, but it's a little detail to explain how he directs us, you know. For every word we say, every phrase we say, he has a subtext which has nothing to do, but which helps to create the whole character.
Yeah, and on the top of the subtext, you have what not only the words, the subtext say, the situation, but also what the music is saying. And what is wonderful with David is that he understands the musical line. And it doesn't stick to it either, or to the text either. He understands the relationship between all these components and the personality at stake, and he makes it work, which is absolutely wonderful.
We haven't talked much so far about the conducting element. There's so much going on in that first act of Manon from your point of view, Emmanuel. You start out with one style, and once Manon comes on, you move into another style. You have the chorus is on stage at one point. So what are your priorities stylistically in going through that first
act? Well, first of all, you try to put it together. And I think... It's so well written. You're totally right. It's jumping from one color and one episode to something which is all of a sudden much thinner but very difficult to grasp. For instance, the first aria of Manon is kind of, she's kind of dizzy, or it's written like that, and it has to be lightly orchestrated, and you have to react to that. Things go from one to the other very naturally. You know, it's so well composed that you actually, in the fire of the action, you just try technically to have things work. I mean, I actually mean it. It needs to be together. But you just follow the flow of the drama developing itself with the music. So it's not... The challenge it's that it's quite long. And you need to react very fast. And you need to understand what's going on very fast. It's not like all of a sudden, okay, now it's the cabaletta, it's in four for 60 bars, and I just go and I hope the soprano stays. Here you have to each second react to what is going on. But that's very true of all the music of Massenet. It's especially long, but that's okay. We can deal with it.
Right. I wanted to go back to talk just a little bit about these two characters' progress through the opera, because each act is so different. Natalie, I'm wondering how you would hope your audience will respond to your character in that transition from Des Grieux to Bretigny, who is a much wealthier man.
Yeah, but you have to explain, Roger, that Bretigny told her that he was going to be kidnapped by the man of his father. And they don't have any money anymore, and she will end up in the street. So what can she do?
Get a job.
At that time, Roger, again, at that time, she doesn't have any background. First, she's not from a rich family, and she can't work. She has no choice. At that time, a young girl like her would either marry a rich man or go to the convent. That's it.
Can you talk about how her life changes as far as her whole position in society when she moves from Des Grieux to Bretigny? She's treated sort of like a queen.
Yes, she becomes the queen of Paris. And her heart is broken, but she has everything else. But she still regrets. You know, when she hears, at one point, a conversation between the father and Bretigny speaking of Des Grieux, she's like, Des Grieux? Where is he? Because she doesn't know. And then she learns that he's in Saint-Sulpice, and she goes in Saint-Sulpice right away, without thinking anymore.
How do you keep sympathy for her?
No, but it's not the point.
Oh.
No, that's not the point. The point is that then when she goes to him back, they don't have any money again. He can't work because he's a noble man. His father is probably very, very angry at him. So he won't have any money. So they don't have no choice.
Well, they have some money at the beginning. Just
yeah,
a
but
bit.
It's spent. It's spent.
It's spent. Yeah, it's very, yeah, well, with your lifestyle.
Yeah.
No, I'm talking about the opera, sorry.
No, yeah.
Just to clarify that.
What I find so interesting in the whole gambling scene is that even her vocal character changes because it becomes very aggressive, and you know when she's singing about the thrill of gold and all of that, it's a different kind of Manon.
Yeah, but she wants to persuade herself also. That's the goal they want to achieve together.
Right. Jonas, you made a comparison in our magazine, the interview that you did for it, between Alfredo in Traviata and Des Grieux, and I thought that was very interesting. Traviata is, of course, an opera that all of us here know very well, so could you briefly explain the similarities and the differences between Des Grieux and Alfredo?
Well, I mean, first of all, from my point of view, from the point of view of Des Grieux, it's somehow a similar story, because I mean he is very innocent, he's very unexperienced, he falls in love immediately with that woman who is in Traviata she's real courtesan, but I mean she's also she hasn't behaved well, as she was saying before, so they really, as Emmanuel said, they really fall in love to each other, and then the problem is the father. And the father is that strong father figure who, in Traviata, persuades Traviata to leave him, and it's a similar thing. He just brings me back by force because he doesn't want me to live with her, and that's what I meant. It's very similar, and also much of the things his behavior can be explained or excused by his innocence and his purity or naivety or whatever you would call that, because there are some points where he could have made other decisions. Because, for instance, at the end of fourth act, when the question is, has he really no choice? I mean, both are arrested, and his father says, in front of everybody, says, "Well, but I'm going to let you release soon, because he's so powerful in Paris that he can do that." And he has not the courage to say, "No, I want to stay in prison with her." No, that's crazy. I mean, then month later, he tries to find her, and he tries to persuade her that it's too late. Exactly. So why? So there are several mistakes he's doing, and that's why I was trying to compare it. But obviously, I mean, the circumstances are different, and the several steps they're having. Also, one thing that is very important, which is in the novel much more than it is in the opera, that is that he's extremely jealous. His jealousy is so strong. I think he kills three people in the novel just because they were being too close to her, yeah, looking at her or whatever. So it's the same thing. That's the same problem. No, the same problem in Traviata. He's behaving so badly. He's making her in that scene in at Flora's party. I mean, he's behaving so badly and rude just because he's so jealous, and he's blind of his jealousy. So
there's actually more connection to Traviata and Manon than people think, because in the novel of Dumas-Fils, La Dame aux Camélias, which inspired La Traviata, Marie Duplessis at the beginning is reading Manon, and it's one of the books that was very important to her, and she actually says, "No woman should behave like that." And actually, it goes.
Well, that's interesting.
No, but that goes exactly to the point Nathalie was making. The irony is at the end, although no woman would like to behave like that, the Traviata, or Marie Duplessis in La Dame aux Camélias, is obliged to behave like that because she has no other choice. And so that's actually an interesting reference and interesting connection between the two pieces. And it's an official one because Manon, which was the novel of L'Abbé Prévost, had a great success in itself. And so it was one of those books that people would want to read, especially because it was a little off the beaten path and sulfur was there, yeah.
I want to get back to the music for a bit. I mean, this piece gets progressively more dramatic as it goes on, especially in the Saint-Sulpice scene, this wonderful confrontation between Desgrieux and Manon, which for many people I think is their favorite moment of the opera. So can we talk a bit about that scene and what makes it so memorable musically? I think it's so beautifully constructed, and it also has wonderful aria for you, and then a wonderful aria for you.
It's not really, it's not really an aria. Speaking.
Yeah, I mean, it's the closest to arias in the piece, but what is very interesting in the writing of Massenet in the time is that he's actually going away from this aria, this idea of, well, there is an ensemble, and then there is a recitative, and then there is an aria. Of course, it's not as much as, the first act of Bohème, where whenever I conduct Bohème, I feel it's another audition, because after an aria, there's another famous aria, and then there is another aria that everybody wants to sing. And those two arias are very important. But to answer your question once more, things develop themselves very naturally with Massenet. And that was the lesson he got from Wagner, of all people. He went to Bayreuth in 1864, and was really impressed by that way of not having any more this division between numbers, and there are no numbers in Manon. In Faust of Gounod, for instance, you still have numbers and recitative, and you go from one number to the other. Here, it naturally evolves from one place to the other, and there is almost no room for an applause at the end of the aria. You know, it's not exactly built that way. That act is constructed magnificently. I think what Massenet enjoyed doing was to have a love scene in a church, because all of a sudden that was making the love scene forbidden and even more interesting. And from him as a composer, what was interesting is to include the organ, with all this incredible dimension that it could provide, the notion of space too that you could have. So in that way, the act starts with the organ alone and finishes with the orgy. So it's from the organ to the orgy. That's an interesting trip from a composer, but also because it allows him to do tricks of composers. You know, you have a chorus, you have a church music, very with a contrepoint. You know, several voices put together in a certain way, and then you have this extremely sensual and lush music. So he's playing with that, and the act ends in a great paroxysm. So people don't go home. They wait a little before they go home and they stay. So you are suspended there. So it's brilliantly written, but all of the acts are brilliantly written in that piece.
There's one moment that no one ever talks about, and it's your prayer, which I find the most moving thing in the whole opera. Can you describe Manon's circumstances when she comes to Saint-Sulpice, what she's feeling, what makes her burst out in this way? It's so powerful.
She says, they pray over there, and I would like to be able to pray. She's not. And when she says, pardonnez-moi, Dieu de toute puissance, I do it with rage and almost with, I'm upset with God.
Yeah, she's
it's
swearing.
It's not really a prayer.
It's swearing, yes, more than a prayer. I mean, you can see it like that.
In church.
Yes, in church, yeah.
But isn't she also asking God not only to pardon her, but to soften Des Grieux's heart towards her?
Yeah, and she knows that no God would actually, would actually allow that. So this is blasphemous.
But I've always found it just an incredibly moving.
Yeah.
It lasts for 60 seconds, but is it? I'm glad.
It is.
One wonderful thing in this opera is that we get to hear the two of you speak on the stage, but we get to hear you speak over the music, which is different from your situation in the Godard or the Regiment or Jonas for you in Zauberflöte, where there is no music under you. So how much speaking is actually required of the two of you in Manon?
Not much, but I cut only three lines in the church because it's not a good text.
No, I mean, compared to the amount of singing, it's not much, but it is essential, and it is another way of expressing and of interpretation, I would say, because you're very much banned, let's say, with the ideas of the composer while you're singing, because the music is so strong, and it is written, as Emmanuel said before, in a very expressive, very emotional way, which you can't avoid. I mean, you can't say no, I'm going to do it completely different. It won't work. But the dialogue is something that is much more, gives you much more free and much more possibilities to choose, and you can say a phrase in so many different moods, and it changes completely the situation. There, I think, is for the actors the challenge, I think, to make the dialogue very natural and thrilling. But it's my personal impression.
Emmanuel, this was fairly unusual at the time, was it not, to set spoken dialogue in French opera over musical accompaniment?
No, not totally. It is originally an opéra comique. What you call opéra comique doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be funny, although most of them are lighter than what you would call the grand opéra or the drame lyrique. But opéra comique just means you have dialogues. And usually you have numbers, then you have a few dialogues that make the action progress, and then when the action has progressed, they can complain or rejoice about the action and let the music express that. But sometimes, even in other opera comique, you would have at moments the dialogues over the music, melodrama. So that was not totally uncalled for in the time. What is interesting is the way he's using that and the way he's dealing with it. I think it is at some point an element at the same time of realism in the story. All of a sudden he's trying to say to people, Massenet as a composer, look, these are real people. This is a real story unfolding in front of you. And at the same time, it makes the singing voice something more spectacular, more strange. And that connection between the spoken voice, the music, the orchestra underneath, and all of a sudden a vocal line that's going to develop itself kind of makes you dizzy and makes you all of a sudden be aware of where you are in the action, in the situation, but also in the opera house itself. It's a kind of a wake-up call. Oh, this is actually something which is stylized. This is not really happening, but then it must be even truer or more important to follow the real authenticity of the characters. I think this is very interesting, and he does it in a very brilliant way, how he's playing from one way of producing the human voice or one style of theater to the very elaborate singing style.
Now, you know, this is an audience that knows Manon Lescaut. We just Yes. did it a couple of years ago. We've done it several times. We've only done Manon twice before. Emmanuel, how do you compare the experience of conducting Massenet versus the Puccini? Do they satisfy you equally?
Yes. I mean, for conductors, Puccini is a great reward, but so is Massenet. I've done probably 10 Massenet opera by now, and Manon, I haven't done Manon in years, which is great fun for me to rediscover the piece, especially under those amazing, I can't say that enough, circumstances, which is a fantastic stage director and a totally ideal cast for it, which is something even in great historical houses as the Lyric Opera House, you don't find very often. I mean, you don't find very often such a combination of amazing talent that do fit exactly the piece. Massenet and Puccini have very often been compared, and somehow Massenet is the French Puccini, and the French people being so bad at supporting their geniuses, it didn't have the career that Puccini had. When Puccini wrote Manon Lescaut after the Manon of the Massenet version, and when he was said, well, why are you doing this? Manon is already Massenet, and he says, well, Manon is a lady that is strong enough to have several men. So she's going to, and Puccini was so aware of his own genius that he was not afraid of the comparison. It's different. In a way, the story is treated differently. The relationship of Manon Lescaut with of Manon with I don't remember the character in the but what would be Bretigny in the Receveur Général is totally developed in a very interesting way. Actually, when she says, "I am in a jail of diamonds, but I am in a jail," in Puccini, she dies in a desert in Louisiana, which makes people laugh here. Of course, but which we all like. And actually, you have French tourists every year. We are going to Louisiana. I want to see the desert. You know, it's fine. But I think if I try, because you see, Roger, I'm trying to answer cleverly to your question. And I think the difference is that with Puccini, with an absolute genius, the feelings and the situation and the orchestration always express themselves in a very tight connection that is happening in the moment. With Massenet, it's always authentic, as we were saying. It's always very well felt. The poetry is great. But there is also always an element of slight distanciation and stylization. That means that he's always saying, this is the picture of Manon. This is what she is as a young girl. This is what happens at this moment. But you have always this aesthetical frame that it does through an orchestration or the way the scene is brought that makes it definitely more French in that distance. That doesn't mean the feelings are not as powerful or as authentic, but there is always a slight distance in the way it is presented.
Right. Natalie and Jonas, I wanted to ask both of you if there is more French opera in your future. Are you thinking about certain roles that have been sort of dreams that you would like to realize? I know you, Mathilde, you have a Mélisande coming.
Yes, I'm preparing Mélisande.
Right. Is that something that you've been...
Yeah, it was one of my favorite opera. So I like the music so much that I'm really enjoying to do it. And I would like to do Blanche de la Force. In Le Dialogue.
Dialogue becomes Poulain.
Because I love the Bernanos, and I love this text, and I love this play about the fear. And I would like to experience that in my life.
Mm-hmm. So finally, you will go to the convent.
Yeah, exactly.
Finally.
That's it.
See?
Jonas, you're so remarkably versatile in the way you are able to excel so in a way that I think very few German tenors have been able to do in both German and French and Italian repertoire. But I'm specifically interested in where you want to go with the French side after Des Grieux.
Well, the next thing that is definitely missing is Werther. I've never done Werther, so it's extremely obvious that I should do that. And Comte Hoffmann. I haven't done that either. So there are two pieces that I'm going to work on in the next 2 years. And then let's see. I mean, there are many more to come. But as you were saying, so I'm trying to drive on three roads at the same time. So there's not always time for a stop on on each lane.
I'm sure that all of you have lots of questions for this panel. So... who are so remarkable. I think we've all learned so much about this piece. So let me just start.
Dialog de Camélie.
Hold on, we have more. Time for some questions. First hand I saw was right here. And I panel, I need to repeat the question before you answer.
Yes.
The question is, in the opera, do Bretigny and Manon get married?
She hides marriage.
Yes, but it's she wants to delay it as long as possible.
No, and at that time you could have a position as a mistress and not get married, and that's actually what, in a certain way, she's going after. She knows she's already dirty, between quotes, and she will never marry legitimately, but she's trying to get a guy that would be rich enough to pay for her to stay somewhere. For life, my dear.
Yes, yeah. That's what they
possible.
Did.
Life was short in the time, but...
Yes. Yes. The difference between the Puccini Manon and the Massenet Manon.
You know, I don't know very well the Puccini one, but I think that that dramatically the French one is more interesting.
Why?
Because it's...
there are more layers in the character. It's more complex. It's expressed more in a more complex fashion. With the Massenet.
She has a real travel.
The question regards the gavotte from the...
Yes, and what is the question?
Question is...
Okay, just talking about the interpretation of the gavotte which Manon sings in the first scene of Act 3.
When I start to sing an aria, I start to search what is behind. So it's not because you say, oh, let's have fun, that it's the only sense of it. And when you say that, there are many thoughts that you can have at the same time about that. And that's what is interesting for me, to bring many, many layers in one aria. So that's why she's happy at that time, but at the same time she's regretting her love. So she can't be really totally happy.
And actually, that's what Massenet does in the aria. It's all flashy, flashy, incredibly flashy. But then you have this real gavotte in the middle, which is about time passing. And when she says, let's have fun, let's have fun, it's also a fear and anxiety about the fact that this is going to go away. So let's grasp it now. But this let's grasp it now is an expression of a great anxiety, probably.
Ma'am. The question regards where we got the production. The production originated at English National Opera in London.
13 years ago.
And it was the DVD is of the revival that Nathalie did in Barcelona. It's been done in Liège, Belgium, in Auckland, New Zealand, and in, I believe, both Houston and Dallas. So a well-traveled production. Sir, yes. The question regards the letter that Des Grieux is writing to his father, which is the opening of Act Two. He does want to marry her.
Yes, definitely. But I'm totally confident. From the moment I've seen her in Act One, I'm talking about marriage. But for whatever reason, whenever I bring up that, she turns around and starts saying something else, and so she doesn't respond as the way I would have loved her to do. But actually, she says yes somehow. She says yes.
Yeah, okay.
About 5 minutes before those gods of my father are going to bring me away. So.
Yeah, but I don't know that.
Right here, yes? The question is the whole idea of comedy being hard and tragedy being easy for actors, and does the panel agree? Nathalie?
Yes, that's true. Because comedy needs so much rhythm and energy and to be so precise. It's really like a mechanic, you know, like a clock. But to make people cry. With beautiful music already.
That's a piece of cake.
It's easy.
No, it's true. And actually, I would say the most critical public audience are children. So whenever you have a performance where children are sitting there, it means if they are satisfied, then you can show it to everybody, because they see immediately every single mistake, and they start talking and say, oh, that's not true. Oh, please. It's so funny, but it also is really a challenge, because if you do a funny thing in front of children, that's, let's say, the test.
when
if you fail.
When artists have children, I'm always curious as to how they respond to the artist's performance. So do you both have children? What roles have they particularly been interested in, of yours, that is?
They don't care, first. Second, my daughter hates seeing me kissing the tenor. So that's very good that she's not here for the moment.
Jonas, do your kids come
and the baritone? She likes you seeing kissing the baritone.
Yeah, I never kiss the baritone. I only kiss him in private.
No, well, I started when I had only one kid. I started bringing her to performances and also to rehearsals. And it turned out I was going to create a monster, because you see that my daughter was making staging. Tried to stage me in privacy. So she said, "No, so you come over here now and go on your knees, go there now, give mommy a hug." And I said, "What are you doing? No, why you do that all the time when they telling you do it? Why don't you do it?" And so, "No, please, we have to stop that, because otherwise she thinks, I mean, all the life is it goes like that." But then every child is different. My middle one, for instance, he loves opera. He goes very, very rarely, but when he goes, he sits there, he stares at the scene and at the orchestra for the whole time. He doesn't move at all, and it's fantastic. Where my daughter, who turned 10 now, after like 15 minutes, she can't behave, because for her it's something.
She doesn't relate to it.
Yeah, exactly, and she's not touched. She's not touched. She says, "Oh, it's so normal." Yeah, come on, please, can we just go now? So they're different. So,
Nathalie, didn't you base one of your, you've done Conte Hoffmann several times, didn't you base one of your Olympias on your daughter?
Yes. at one point, I had to be a very little girl, so I was a mix of Shirley Temple and my own daughter.
I mean, Nathalie Zarastro, for instance.
Yeah. But is it like a dream that we will never achieve anyway, or?
Your voice is wrong for the role.
Oh, so many. the whole Puccini roles, for example. That's not for me, and it's a pity, because I would be so great. but it's not for my voice. I can't do that. Or the Big Strauss. Die Frau ohne Schatten. Salome. Ah, yeah. Oh, that would be great.
Eunice, do you have one of those roles?
No, not really. I mean, I'm always jealous on the others. I mean, like, I'm jealous. I was mentioning Danacion before, Danacion the First, and Mephisto is just, I mean, hello. These arias, I mean, everything he says, all the text, every recit, I mean, it's so well placed. It's so beautiful. It's, but I probably will never be able to sing that. I don't know. I mean, I'm always dreaming of somebody engaging me to do like the one-man show of Magic Flute or whatever. But still waiting.
Yes. We have run out of time. I want to thank this panel for taking time from the rehearsals to come and speak to us. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.